Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Augustin J. Carrero, whose new book is Tennessee 101, and we'll preview the last weekend of the 35th Annual Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival. We'll also hear from Nathaniel Rich, author of Second Nature, Scenes from a World Remade. Augustin J. Carrero is the founding co-artistic director of the Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans and has directed many productions, including such well-known plays as The Glass Menagerie, Kingdom of Earth, Suddenly Last Summer, The Rose Tattoo, and Camino Real. So who would be better to write Tennessee Williams 101, a brief and lively guide to the playwright and his work? We're talking to Augustin after his last class of the day. He supports his theater habit by working as a theater teacher at John Arrett High School on the West Bank. Augustin Carrero, welcome to The Reading Life.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, what a fun and useful book this is. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was fun to write.
Now, you know, there are all kinds of guides to reading these days. You know, reading pathways, where to begin. If you're looking for this, which 10 books by an author to read, what order to read them in. So people really like having a guide like this. So what went into your thinking about how to organize this material?
The organization of the material came fairly easily because it's an outgrowth of a presentation that I've been doing for a few years at the various Tennessee Williams festivals, whether it's in New Orleans or Provincetown or St. Louis. And it begins essentially as a bullet-pointed PowerPoint and sort of a lively one-hour presentation. And so much of the material that was put into the book started as this presentation, but I quickly learned that turning a one-hour presentation into 50,000 words was a challenge. So the organization was the easy part. It was the fleshing it out and deciding which pieces were vital and which pieces couldn't be left out and which pieces could be left out for the 101 audience. That was the real challenge.
Now, the funny thing is, as a young theater person, you didn't like Tennessee Williams much as a playwright, especially after being in a production of Summer and Smoke in Columbus, Mississippi.
I sure didn't. I think I got a very poor impression from my short experience. And the reason was, I think that I didn't understand the work thoroughly. And I think that the production that I was in was just a little bit timid and missed a little bit of that signature Tennessee Williams fiery desire flair that we've come to associate with him so much. And I just thought it was so dull and maudlin and sort of saccharine. I said, who could like this stuff? Now, of course, I grew up in the Mississippi Delta, like Tennessee did.
Right.
And so there was this expectation that I was supposed to like him. And I think that also played a part into it, because, of course, I wanted to rebel and be my own person. When someone said, oh, you must love Tennessee Williams, I was decidedly, no, absolutely not. So, of course, a little bit of that youthful ego played into my disliking Williams, too. But in retrospect, I realized that a lot more of my problem with Williams was with me and that individual experience, because I did have a teacher who now lives in Lake Charles and is a Louisiana long hauler named Brooke Hanneman. And she really changed my mind about Tennessee Williams in a Tennessee Williams and Women class that I took at Mississippi University for Women. And she really just asked me to reexamine my lens through which I viewed him. And when I did, it was like a light bulb went off. And suddenly I loved Tennessee Williams and couldn't get enough of him.
And sometimes all you need is the right teacher.
Yeah, sometimes you do. So that's what I do, like you said, all day, every day. I try to be the right teacher, and hopefully I'll set off someone else's light bulb.
Now, I think I remember talking with you at the Tennessee Williams Festival in 2006. So talk a little bit. You've been here a while. Tell us about deciding to move and work here and start your theater company.
So 2006 was a big year for me because it was when I graduated from Mississippi University for Women, and it was also my first time visiting the New Orleans Tennessee Williams Literary Festival, and that was with Brooke Hanneman. She was teaching the Williams women class, and she brought us down. And this was, of course, the year following Katrina. And I had been to New Orleans at least a dozen times with my family and on my own before Katrina, but just seeing the city in this completely changed state, I realized that the city that I wanted most in the world to live in was in a really tough state for a young, fresh out of college theater person that wanted to get started. And so I had to avert my gaze for a moment, and I went up to New York City for a time instead. So eventually, after doing some national tours and acting and things like that, I realized that directing and dramaturgy was what I was really truly interested in. And so I convinced my now husband, we have to get down to New Orleans because it's too cold up here, and also he had this great idea that he wanted to create this theater company focused on Tennessee Williams, and he knew the name. He wanted it to be the Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans. And so we did, and then we spent a year or two getting the lay of the land, getting our sea legs, doing some theater around New Orleans, and then we started the company back in 2015. So I took the long route, but I got to New Orleans, which is where I always wanted to live. I was asked recently, you know, do you still feel Tennessee Williams around? And I absolutely do. I think that all the things that drew Tennessee Williams to New Orleans are still crackling in the air. And so we started doing productions first in a church rec room. We did them at Mags on Elysian Fields. We were Catch as Catch Can for the first several years, and we were really just getting to hit our stride when we had to close up shop temporarily due to the pandemic. So that's sort of the long and short of it.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Augustin J. Carrero, author of Tennessee 101. Tennessee Williams 101 has been a standard offering at the festival for a while now. So talk about your audiences. Do you find most of them are well aware of Williams' work? Do you find they come with specific searching questions, or do you find they want to be guided? What sort of response do you get? Do you have the feeling they know enough about him?
I think yes to all of those questions on some level. The audiences that come to the 101s, really, it does take all kinds. I definitely have folks that come in that are fanatics, and they have specific questions that they want to ask, and some of them are gotcha questions, and they take one look at me, and they're like, oh, this little whippersnapper, I'm going to get him with this gotcha question. And usually I try to hold my own, but sometimes they teach me a little something. Afterwards, they'll have an anecdote about a time that they met Williams, for example, or knew somebody that he knew. Then there are folks who do kind of want to be guided or at least given a primer to their festival experience. And that's why very often the 101 has been on the Thursday or Friday of the festival, just to get people sort of baptized for the weekend in the Tennessee Williams water.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are those folks who do know a lot about Tennessee Williams, and it's just nice for them to come in and see this kind of like quick and dirty recap of previously on Tennessee Williams before they go in and start to eat all of their Tennessee Williams morsels over the week. And then there are people who come in who know absolutely nothing, whether they are visitors that just happened to find out there was a festival and had heard about this Tennessee person and have nothing, like don't know him from Adam. There's folks that are coming in with their spouses and they're sitting in this thing because that's where their spouse is, and they're open to finding out some more information but weren't planning on attending. So we really do get everybody. And the response has been overwhelmingly positive enough for it to sell out every year, which, you know, I knock on wood, and I'm very thankful for that, that it continues to draw an audience. Some of them are return offenders, new offenders, and some of them are brand new each year. But it's just something that helps everybody to get at least on a baseline level an awareness of Tennessee Williams as a person, as a writer, and not just as this black and white historical figure that is separate from us. My goal has always been to pull him out from under that museum glass case, dust him off, and share him with the audience, rather than treat him like something that's more of a relic.
Well, you've built something so wonderful for the festival as well. You know, it's a really wonderful tradition. One of the things you do in this book that is so wonderful, Augustine, I have to tell you, is that you make him irresistible. I mean, you really do. And you do this great job summarizing the themes that draw us to his work. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I think that Tennessee Williams was such a human, mm-hmm. and he put that on display by being a poet first and a playwright second. And even though he won his Pulitzers for plays, and he had movies with Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh and so on, Elizabeth Taylor, Paul Newman, the language that really grabs you by the solar plexus and yanks you in for that hot, smoky Tennessee Williams kiss is always poetry. And he strikes at these chords of humanity because he lived his life with his heart on his sleeve, and he surrounded himself with diverse and interesting people whom it was very clear he understood on a core level. And so when he wrote that poetically and when he shared that insight with people, he did become irresistible. You hear a Tennessee Williams phrase, and you're like, I don't know what that means, but I know it's true.
Right.
And so that's one of the things that makes him so irresistible. And those themes are just those universal human themes of desire, things like being drawn to something, even though it's not good for us. I feel it every time I drive past the donut shop. and I don't know if that's exactly the feeling that he's conveying, but, you know, similar.
Yeah.
And then the feelings of nostalgia and worrying that you aren't as great as other people say. All of these things are, I think, people really relate to them. And his relatability means that you just kind of either want to be his friend or you want to just give him a hug. Hopefully that's what you mean when you say he's irresistible.
We've been talking with Augustine J. Carrero, founding co-artistic director of the Tennessee Williams Theater Company of New Orleans and the author of Tennessee Williams 101. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for his appearance times and the company's theater offerings at the festival, the Felt Menagerie. Augustine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
New Orleans writer Nathaniel Rich is the author of the nonfiction work Losing Earth, as well as the novels King Zeno, Odds Against Tomorrow, and The Mayor's Tongue. He is also a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine and a regular contributor to The Atlantic and the New York Review of Books. Today we're talking about his new book, Second Nature, a collection of his journalism about the post-natural world. It is harrowing and fascinating, and much of it concerns Louisiana. Nathaniel Rich, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Great to speak with you again, Susan. It's good to be here.
So tell us about pursuing this line of inquiry for you. There's a fluorescent green rabbit on the cover of this book, and you're taking us from Louisiana all over the world with these stories.
I have to say, first of all, if I'm a little distracted, it's because there's a window out to a couple of gorgeous ancient sycamore trees that my new neighbor has decided to cut down. That's what's going on. It seems sort of fitting given the subject of the book, which is really about how we've completely altered the natural world to the point where there's nothing natural about the world as we know it. And that through our actions, human beings have reconfigured the entire planet, you know, mostly to our own specifications, with catastrophic results. And I think the way the book started was really with that realization. I was writing a story about this wild plan by Stuart Brand, futurist and best known as the founder of Whole Earth Catalog. he has an organization called Revive and Restore with his wife that is attempting to bring back species that have gone extinct through genetic processes. And I was speaking with one of the lead scientists on the endeavor, and he made the point to me very clearly, there's no such thing as the natural world by any definition of nature, that we've reconfigured every square inch of land through our activities, whether purposefully or without realizing it, through, you know, altering the climate, say, or deforestation or, you know, pollution and so on. And so that forced me into a sort of greater struggle with trying to come to terms with that idea and the many ramifications that follow from it, which are just to say, well, if we've already changed the world in so many ways, are there ways that we can change it for the good? Are there ways that we can repair some of the damage that we've done? Or are there ways at least to live in a more responsible way? And it was the beginning of a longer, you know, process of thinking about ecology of the modern world and what kind of role we should have and how we should think about these big questions that are really shaking the underpinnings of all of society and human culture.
And how we live and will live in the future. I mean, you divided the essays into three parts, and the first part is called Crime Scene, and it's about some really terrifying, you know, scenes from a world remade, as the subtitle says. You know, you start in a town in West Virginia that's being ravaged by DuPont's chemical dumping, and you center on an unlikely hero who begins life as a corporate lawyer.
Yeah, the early stories are really about people, and I should say all the stories are, you know, written in third person about people who are grappling with these huge changes and trying to figure out what to do about them. And Rob Ballot, who was a corporate lawyer in Cincinnati, his family was from West Virginia, was for me the perfect example of this kind of trajectory that takes place in many of these stories and that I think we all are going through to some degree, which is that he comes to the realization that DuPont, the world's biggest chemical company and a company that he felt did good work, and you know, he was a corporate lawyer whose job was to defend against environmental claims, chemical companies, and he unraveled over the series of years this incredible conspiracy by DuPont to use a chemical, a man-made chemical called PFOA, that poisons the blood of every living creature on the planet, and has been used in Teflon and all kinds of waterproof materials made by DuPont and other corporations that are found in cars and airplanes and all kinds of consumer products, and has now been so infiltrated society that we all carry this poison in our bloodstream. And so for this lawyer, it was just a steady unraveling of this incredible decades-long conspiracy to keep this information from the public. And, you know, it's extremely disillusioning for him, as it's disillusioning, I think, for us whenever we encounter this kind of level of transformation and depravity. And he set about trying to hold DuPont responsible. And it's this incredible saga that goes decades. And the story was made into a great movie that I'd recommend anyone to see if they haven't seen it, that was released last year called Dark Waters, mm-hmm. Mark Ruffalo. It's a shocking, wild story in itself. But it also came for me to symbolize this larger passage that I think we're all going through, which is trying to reckon with exactly what we've done, how wide the scope has been. Can't get any more pernicious and deep than creating a chemical that is in the blood of every living creature, as PFOA is. And I should say, with all kinds of horrible effects.
So much of what you write about is the story of passionate individuals, scholars, researchers, people who become obsessed, you know, like John Irving says, you got to get obsessed and stay obsessed. And I think of Ben Novak, who grew up wanting to save the passenger pigeon against all odds, even though he'd never seen one in flight.
It's incredible. I mean, when I met him, I saw the whole story unfolding. I mean, I'm certainly drawn to obsessives. As an obsessive, as I think probably any writer is on some level, I'm drawn to obsessive characters and people who give their lives to something bigger than themselves. And yes, Ben Novak was this sort of interesting, nerdy science nerd in the middle of North Dakota who fell in love with this extinct species, the passenger pigeon, which, you know, none of his friends had ever heard of 80 years before he was born. I guess a little earlier was the most populous bird in the continent, if not the entire world, and was ultimately killed off. mainly by hunters, and but also deforestation and other human intervention. And he became obsessed, and he decided to devote his life to bringing it back. And he's doing it, and he expects through Stuart Brand's group that they're going to be able to do it. But it's the story of sort of wild obsession, but also this deep love for something that doesn't exist anymore. He strikes me as an artist figure, even though
yeah,
technically a scientist now. One of the other projects, I should say, you know, that a lot when people talk about the extinction, they talk about bringing woolly mammoths back.
Yeah,
the passenger pigeon project. But they have a lot of different projects now in different species, including some species that are not extinct yet, but are critically endangered. And one thing they try to do is use genetic methods to help bring back these species, essentially by the genetic pool of these species as they get closer to extinction narrows down. And when they do produce offspring, there's more inbreeding and there's less likely to survive. And so their idea is to genetically engineer new animals that have more divergent DNA so that they can have more productive offspring. And so they've done that this week. Mm-hmm. Or a couple of weeks ago, they've just cloned a black-footed ferret, which is a very cute endangered species. They've done it with a partnership of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and Novak was in the New York Times and all over the internet last week cradling this new ferret, this newly born ferret that's the clone of a ferret that died in 1988.
Wow.
And
wow,
the beginning of this process to use genetic engineering to bring back this species. And it seems like a small thing, you know, the black-footed ferret is probably not something that anyone spent a lot of time thinking about until you start to consider the larger ramifications that, you know, if we can use genetics to rescue species and bring back extinct species. You know, that's almost the tip of the iceberg, as it were. And so what I wanted to write about was not just, you know, that his obsession, but where this is all headed. If it becomes, mm-hmm. Acceptable to do this, what does that mean for the future? And what does that, of course, ultimately mean for using these same methods on human beings?
Well, it seems from reading this book that so much of our future depends on the passion of people who fight on against the odds. I mean, some of it is actually marketing the invisible. Why should we care about bringing back the passenger pigeon? It's not as cute as the black-footed ferret. Why a jellyfish? Why are we drawn to stories of large, cute animals? And you refer to Jurassic Park a couple of times in this book as both a lure to do this work and a cautionary tale.
I think we have a healthy anxiety as a society about humans monkeying around natural processes and mm-hmm. having a healthy fear of unintended consequences. Of course, the climate change is the immediate example, but certainly there's a lot of anxieties about failed efforts to use technological solutions to problems that we've created through our own bungling or inattention or neglect. And I think that's good. However, we're now reaching the place where the world has already been transformed irrevocably,
right.
From anything that could be thought of as a natural condition. And so the question is really, you know, how can we be more responsible? We're already putting our rubbing mitts on everything. You know, how can we do so in such a way that not only doesn't do damage, but tries to reverse some of these problems or tries to create a new kind of nature that is consistent with our better angels.
We've been talking with Nathaniel Rich, whose new book is the very scary and at times very moving Second Nature, Scenes from a World Remade. Nathaniel, thank you so much as always.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a thrill as always.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. This is the final weekend of the virtual Tennessee Williams in New Orleans Literary Festival. Watch for appearances by Megan Abbott, Augustin J. Carrero, Randy Fertel, Allison Galen, Matthew Griffin, Eliza Griswold, Lady Hubbard, Robert Jones Jr., Peggy Scott Laborde, Laura Lippman, Lauren Markham, John Cameron Mitchell, John Pope, Alice Quinn, Mo Rocca, Brian Sands, Kalamu Yassalam, Heather Ann Thompson, Emma Walsh, and a host of others. One of the concluding events will be the presentation of the 7th Annual Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Writing. That's at 4:30 Sunday. Honorees this year are Angie Kim for her debut novel Miracle Creek, Emma Copley Eisenberg for her true crime story The Rainbow Girl, that's a new prize this year, and C.S. Harris, also known as New Orleanian Candace Proctor, who will receive the prize for a distinguished body of work. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the complete weekend schedule. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library hold a really, really old book sale Saturday, March 27th. Hours are 10 to 11 a.m. for Friends members and 11 a.m. to 2 to the public, all at Ladder Library, 5120 St. Charles Avenue. Nathaniel Rich discusses his new book, Second Nature, Scenes from a World Remade, in a Zoom conversation with Thomas Beller, Monday, March 29th at 6. Get tickets at GardenDistrictBookshop.com. And the New Orleans Poetry Festival gets underway this coming week and continues throughout the month of April. Check out NOLAPoetry.com for the complete schedule. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.